Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I thought we would start with some interesting things that came in my little email box. But, oh, I should tell you what that email box is. It's askdrdawn.com. You just go there and click the Contact Us, and you can type in your email, and we're happy, happy, happy to see your emails. So I've got two right here that we're going to talk about. Let's start with one from Ethan in Pembroke Pines, Florida. Always love it when I get those out of state because I know that's someone who's listening online. And big shout out of appreciation to my online podcast listeners. And by the way, you can do that also just at any most places where fine podcasts are served. But also you can go to AskDrDawn.com and listen. And decide whether you want to subscribe to the podcast. Here we go. Ethan's letter. Please let me add my name to the list of those who appreciate you taking the time to do this show, which is a valuable public resource. I've been a listener for years for the education and general information, but recently my mother, age 71, was diagnosed with Parkinson's. So I'm in the process of reading about it to get a handle on exactly what that entails. I was wondering if you have a perspective on it from a functional medicine angle. Well, it's always a good bet that I'll have a perspective from a functional medicine angle. In particular, I'm interested in the potential of a gut microflora connection and if any particular probiotics have been demonstrated to help with the condition. So thanks in advance for any information you may want to discuss. And thank you, Ethan, because I thought, well, that's an interesting question. I haven't really checked that for a couple of years. And boy, jackpot, there's a ton of stuff in the literature. And I've got my web people assistants out there pulling articles, but I have a couple of abstracts that I thought you might be interested in for the program. And essentially, I'm going to start with the famous random double-blind placebo-controlled clinical trial, because that's what everybody always says. It's like, well, if there's not a placebo trial, you haven't proven anything. Okay, let's start with the placebo trial. This was published in Clinical Nutrition, Volume 38, Issue 3, June 2019. So it's hot off the presses. It's fact, it's come from the future. I wish I had an echo thing, you know, because that really needed that. Future, future, future. Clinical and metabolic response to probiotic administration in people with Parkinson's disease, just a randomized double-blind placebo-controlled trial. So basically what they did was they gave people 8 times 10 to the 9th colony-forming units. So that's in the 6 is a mil. That's in like the billion range. That's like 8 billion or placebo. And by the way, I consider that they were using a low dose probiotic. Let's see, they had 56 people, 60 people, they divided them into 30. They ran it for 3 months. They started by doing a indicating rating scale. That's a validated rating scale called Movement Disorders Society Unified Parkinson's Disease Rating Scale, which probably involves things like, you know, timing a person with a stopwatch and having them get up from a chair and walk across the room and do other motor trials. So they also measured C-reactive protein because why not? And they found that the probiotic compared to placebo decreased the score on the rating scale. That's good. And the probability on that was P equals 0.01, so that's a high probability, a 1 out of 100 chance that it was accident. Probiotic supplementation also reduced high sensitivity C-reactive protein, meaning it was anti-inflammatory. Ooh, that one was even better. Chance of a false result, 1 in 1,000, not 1 in 100. They also showed malondialdehyde, which is a marker for inflammation. That went down at 6 in 1,000. Chances of a false result. Enhanced glutathione, and we're at 0.03 in comparison with a placebo. All good anti-inflammatory things. They also got a statistically significant reduction in insulin levels, insulin resistance, and we're back up into the 2 in 1,000 chance of a fall, so 0.002. These are really significant results, folks. And a rise in insulin sensitivity. And probiotic effect had no impact on other metabolic profiles. Wow. Makes me stand by my results that everybody should be taking some probiotics. But this is really phenomenal that in just 6 weeks, they were able to show an improvement in movement in Parkinson's patient. Now, here's another really interesting suggestion. And this is just a little bit of, wow, this is really deep stuff. But, and I don't have the full article, although I hope to get it, but this is called Microbiota Gut-Brain Signaling, Implications for Non-Motor Symptoms. And what they found was that the probiotics can, that a lot of the alpha-synuclein that is found in the brain, actually it starts in the gut. So it's all, so this inflammatory compound that accumulates in the brain may actually be coming from the gut and traveling up the vagus nerve into and getting into the brain. It's a very, very intriguing hypothesis, and I want to emphasize this is observational and hypothetical, but I want to read this. Okay, and this is in studies looking at Parkinson's disease, and I don't know if it's humans or animals because I don't have the full article. Alpha-synuclein aggregates, the cardinal neuropathological feature in Parkinson's disease, are present in both the submucosal and myenteric plexuses of the gut nervous system prior to their appearance in the brain. Now, it may just be that what causes Parkinson's disease first affects the gut, and then you start to make this abnormal protein. So it may not be traveling. It may just be a domino effect. This remains to be seen, but isn't it interesting how an email can start us off on such an interesting thread? And you can be sure I'll keep digging in this department because I am very intrigued to see what happens. This one from Fred in Bradley, another confusing report, just wondering your take. The 426 issue of the week, healthcare, supplements may be harmful, Tufts University study. A co-author, Fang Zhang, you got to love that name. The health benefits, I'm quoting, the health benefits and risks of dietary supplement use are controversial. Study, to evaluate the association among supplement use, levels of nutrient intake from foods and supplements, and mortality among adults. They looked at data from 1999 to 2010, linked to mortality data. They had 30,000, almost 31,000 people aged 20 or older. They answered a question on dietary supplement use and nutrient intake from foods and supplements. Basically, how much do you eat of X, Y, and Z? They also included mortality from all causes, cardiovascular disease, and cancer. Now, here, this is a really wonderful study in what it didn't do. One of the things that I don't think they did, but let me come back to that. Results. During a median follow-up of 6.1 years, there were 3613 deaths, 945 cardiovascular, and 805 cancer. Ever use of dietary supplements was not associated with mortality. Adequate intake, at or above the estimated average requirement of vitamin A, K, magnesium, zinc, and copper, was associated with reduced all-cause or cardiovascular mortality, but the associations were restricted to nutrient intake from foods. Excess intake of calcium had increased risk of cancer death. Multivariate ratio, I won't give you the stats. Calcium intake from supplements increased deaths is basically the gist of it. And this was in deaths from supplements rather than food. Their conclusion is use of dietary supplements is not associated with mortality of benefits among U.S. adults. Okay, folks, so let's start out with if you're going to talk about dietary intake of nutrients, you kind of need to realize that people who are eating more food may be getting more nutrients, but they may also be getting more calories and they may also be gaining more weight. So the fatal flaw of this study, well, there's two really, one of which is I would not expect the use of supplements to do butt kiss, which I think you can say on the radio, right? Yeah. Okay. My producer says okay. I would not expect it to do butt kiss in 6 years. If you want to study nutrients, you need a 20 or 30 year study. Try doing that on a budget. Really hard. Also, they don't control for weight or age. And if you're getting older, you're probably taking more supplements. And if you have cardiovascular, if you're getting older, you might be taking calcium at more higher probability, which you would also have a higher probability of death. So deeply flawed study, when you aggregate things all together, you can get trends that are kind of like, well, you know, people who talked to a funeral home were more likely to die in the next decade. Don't call a funeral home and you won't die, being the conclusion. Yeah, well, not so much. Couple of public alerts, health alerts. Let's do the first one, because I was driving down Ocean Avenue I was driving down Water Street. I was going to turn left on Ocean. I got caught at a light. I looked to my right and I saw the Starbucks that's right there on the corner, and they had cold brew Cascara coffee. You know, and I thought, Cascara coffee? Are you kidding me? So here's the scoop on Cascara, C-A-S-C-A-R-A. It's a laxative. It could be a flavoring. And okay, so that would be fine, except this is not a benign agent. And, you know, I've seen people using it the dose that people typically use for constipation is about 300 milligrams of extract, which is not a big dose. I have no idea how much they're putting in the coffee, but I'm really worried about this because it's addictive, okay? And there's a history of corporations putting addictive substances into things like, tobacco comes to mind. How about maltodextrin in food, in snack food? Yeah, well, Cascara, if you start using it, you will soon need to use it. It's recommended that you only use it for 6 days in a row at that 300 milligram dose. Long-term use can cause dependence, and even at lower doses, you may cause dependence at lower doses, and that's a known thing. There's also a problem with drug interactions, and this one really worries me, because who's going to imagine that Cascara is going to interact with their digitalis or the digoxin, or with their diuretic pills, or, and here's the really scary one, with their Coumadin. Okay, so this particular substance could potentially increase the anticoagulation effect of Coumadin, leading to an increased risk of hemorrhage. Now, I can't tell you if it's safe, because I tried to find how much they're putting in there. I tried to get a milligram. If anybody can find it, please let me know. And if it's like 2 milligrams for flavor, okay, probably not a problem. And that's but more than that, over a long period of time, and particularly in older people, I'm like, not so much. So that was one for everybody. The other one is for doctors, nurses, first responders, because we still have a measles thing going on, and I know that the dialogue has been kind of shifted, but essentially all it takes is someone who comes in from, let's say, Bulgaria or Israel, where they have really substantial measles issues, and or goes to visit Israel and has had their immunity wane. And by the way, the people whose immunity has waned are the ones who are more likely to get this atypical measles syndrome in adults. It was first described after people had been vaccinated with the old inactivated measles vaccine. Between 1963 and 1967, there was an inactivated vaccine. A lot of people got that. Some sites are saying they were using that as late as 1983, but actually that was the other viral version. But essentially, if you got vaccinated as a kid in the 60s, you have no idea what you got. And if you were born after 1957, but before 1983, you very likely are not fully vaccinated because we weren't giving two shots to kids. If you're a healthcare provider, you probably were. So I'm not so worried about you. But if you're not sure, either get a measles titer, which is a blood test, or simply get a second shot. And you're pretty bomb-proof at that point. This was a 29-year-old man who'd never gotten a vaccination. This is a case report that was actually coming from the A. Marseille University in France. So I think I probably pulled that off. Oh, it actually was reported in British Medical Journal. The thing I want to talk about here is that it's a really different-looking disease. You don't show up with a cold. Typically with measles, you show up with a cold, then you get a fever, then you get a rash, and people go, oh, it's measles. Maybe in the early stages of the cold, you might get some white spots inside your cheeks that a doctor who's looking for measles will spot. Those are called Koplik spots. Love the web, K-O-P-L-I-K, if you want to see them. Anyway, those are the typical childhood measles. If you're older, you get something really different. And you get fever, shortness of breath, rapid development of pneumonia in about 30% of the cases. And this is a different kind of pneumonia. It's nodular. They will often get these pulmonary, they'll often get big wads of lymph nodes in the middle of the chest in the area called the mediastinum. And they often get swelling in their hands and feet. So what I want the first responders and the professionals who are listening to me to take home from this is if you see hand and foot swelling, if you can't make out the veins and the tendons on the back of the feet, and you've got a fever, and you've got any kind of rash, because this adult one can be vesicular. It can actually look like chicken pox, and it can look a little bit like shingles rash, except it'll be all over the body. Anyway, fever, rash, swollen hands and feet, and shortness of breath, you're going to want to treat that as measles, and you're going to want to put them in respiratory ISO, and they're going to get potentially really, really sick. Mortality, if they get the pneumonia, is about 30%. That's high, folks. And I've seen this in action in the mid-80s, when we figured out this thing about, oops, we better give a second measles vaccine. I think that's why they're using the 1983 figure there, is that after that, you were young, and 5 years later in 1988, when we figured this out, you got your second shot. But those of you who were fully vaccinated, quote unquote, and didn't get a second shot after 1988, well, maybe you should think about getting a titer or a second shot. I want to emphasize that we are being precautionary here, but this thing is one of the more contagious diseases, and if it has this kind of effect in adults, and we have a large cohort of partially vaccinated or unvaccinated adults, we got trouble in River City if this thing ever goes, pardon the expression, viral. This was sent by another regular listener, Troy. Troy sent me an article, How Light Therapy Could Protect the Brain, and I'm going to just read you some highlights. Researchers at MIT in Cambridge found that shining a flickering light into the eyes of mice could reduce the buildup of amyloid and tau proteins that occur in the brain with Alzheimer's disease. Light therapy boosts a brainwave form called gamma oscillation. We also see this when people get lots of good deep sleep. And this appeared in the journal Neuron. It showed that if you just use light and you shine it at the rate of gamma oscillation, you get gamma oscillation in the brain increased, and it has a lot of far-reaching effects. So these people, this researcher is Lihui Tsai, and this lab has been researching this for a while. We covered a more preliminary study of gamma oscillation about a year ago on the podcast, somewhat before we started up on this station, but still I remember it because I was interested about entrainment of gamma oscillation. And, well, they were too. So here's the study. First of all, people with Alzheimer's show alteration with reduced gamma oscillation, and people show the reduced gamma oscillation early in their Alzheimer's disease. But the question is this a chicken or an egg? Is the protein starting to accumulate and it's affecting the brain? Can we do anything to maybe get in front of it? And so this was a study using mouse models of Alzheimer's. Tau P37 and CKP25. I want to stop for a moment and say something about mouse models of Alzheimer's. Because the way they make them is they say, oh, look at that. There's a lot of tau protein. Let's engineer a mouse with a defective tau protein that accumulates rapidly, and that'll be our Alzheimer's model. And same thing for P25, which is similar to the other proteins that we see, the beta amyloid accumulation. It's a subset of beta amyloid, in fact. So those are the markers. We make mice that accumulate them, and then we test our drugs, which work really well on the mouse and actually make Alzheimer's patients worse. So I want to point out that this is a flawed model, and I'm not sure that the success in a flawed model will work in humans. It is, however, interesting, and I would not be surprised if some enterprising person came up with a light that blinks at the frequency that induces gamma activity in the brain and started selling it, saying it's protective in mice. It might be protective in you. Send in $29.95 and we'll send you your lamp. If I were that kind of person, I might consider making the lamp, but I'll wait until I have human data before I promote or recommend anything. However, the mice did get better, or rather, they did not get worse as quickly as the control group, which is something. And the researchers were also looking at gene activity in the microglia, which are the immune cells that clean away cell debris. And they found that they looked at genes that promote inflammation, and those were more active in the mice who didn't get light therapy. And they were markedly absent, the inflammatory genes in the mice who got the light therapy. And the mice who got the light therapy had increased activity in genes that cause the microglia to be more active. And so it looks like the light therapy might be causing the janitor cells to work a little harder and maybe clear out more debris. It's still a chicken and the egg issue. And like I said, it's in a flawed model choice. Our last short thing is from the New York Times, and it talks about Juul vowing. Juul is the people who makes the really cute little vape machine with the juicy fruit gum flavors that has caused a whole bunch of middle schoolers to get addicted to nicotine. Oh, yeah, you're not supposed to be able to sell it to minors. Good luck with that. I mean, I was going in and getting beer for parties at 15. I mean, come on. It's just not a problem you can't make the vendors not sell to minors. It's too hard. And you can't really enforce it. What we need is clear penalties for the industry, not the vendors. So in Columbia, South Carolina, there is a vast new army of Juul lobbyists that's aggressively pushing measures that undermine a pledge that Juul made, by the way, saying that it was committed. They went to before Congress and said, we're committed to reduce doing whatever we can do to keep this product from minors. Then they sent, there's 80 plus lobbyists all over this country, and they're fighting proposals to ban the cigarette pods, the flavored ones. They're pushing legislation, I love this, that at the state level that would deny local governments, say City of New York, City of Santa Cruz, the right to adopt vaping controls. And they're making sure that if bills do get through that are designed to discourage youth vaping, that they don't have, that the enforcement measures have been gutted. So they're posing as a public health advocate, while behind the scenes, they are doing everything they possibly can to undermine the stance that they are taking publicly. Most of the state lobbyists work for well-connected firms, lobby firms, run by ex-governors, former state lawmakers, and big political donors. Guess what? This is, you know, the system's kind of dirty, and when you leave the FDA, you can get a job with pharma, and apparently when you leave Congress or you leave the state legislature, you can get a job with a lobbying firm. Because, hey, you've played golf with these guys. We've seen it with cigarettes, and we're seeing it again, the same thing. We've seen it with Coca-Cola. I had a article that I was going to try and translate from the French, and you know, I might just try hitting Google Translate because I really don't want to try to simultaneously I read it in French, but I don't want to try to simultaneously translate, and I'll probably come out very jumbled if I do. But basically, the gist of this is that this is what Coca-Cola has been doing in Europe to try and influence, well, a lot of things, but basically to influence the sales of soft drink. And they have been engaging in some really interesting Trojan horse sorts of work. Essentially, they've been doing a lot of funding of medical conferences. They've been working with the medical industry. They have been creating fake institutes of health, fake public organizations that link donors to researchers. And essentially what they do is they create an institute of money launderers that pays for the study. Then the researcher says, well, my funding was provided by this institute that sounds, you know, very clean. It's just a shield. I think we need to look very carefully now at this tactic. It's been revealed by Le Monde. I suspect that it's a big deal in the United States as well. If you go to a medical conference, there's a pay-to-play thing for the vendors, right? And there's always a big exhibit hall. Well, the pay-to-play, as it worked out in France, is juices and rehydration drinks, because you know everybody needs to be rehydrated. And so electrolyte drinks, sugary electrolyte drinks, are a kind of weird way to fool people into thinking that they're not getting a lot of sugar. And guess what? They actually are. We're going to take a phone call now. And so we're going to Liz in, Liz of Indiana in Las Vegas. Hello, Liz. Are you on the air? Do you hear me?
Yes, I am, Dawn.
Okay.
Hey, that was a great lead-in, because that was another question you reminded me of that I have, and it is, what is my question's about electrolytes, but I wanted to know what the purpose is in the sugar in the 811 drink that you recommend.
Okay.
Is it necessary?
Yes, yes. And there's this really fascinating thing called the sodium glucose ATP transporter. And it's like a coin-op revolving door. Like, you know, this old subway tokens, you know, where you put a coin in and then the turnstile would move?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so think about it, a turnstile on the cell wall, and you have to put a sugar molecule in, and then it pulls in the sodium against the osmotic gradient. So in other words, it pulls water and sodium together. And the cost is one molecule of glucose. And so these turnstiles are all over the lining of the stomach. And so it's the principle that was discovered back in the 70s of, quote, oral rehydration fluid. And it is literally, if you drink the stuff, it's as fast as an IV. And it gets into the bloodstream. So you could take someone who is just, as one would say in French, crevé, which is like withered and completely out of juice, and just juice them back up like you were pumping it up with an IV. And so when this discovery has saved untold millions of children in the third world with diarrhea, because it's a little salt, a little sugar in the right proportions, and some boiled water, and if you need to make it taste good, well, then, you know, then you get into all the industry. I think you got the Pedialytes and the Kaopectate rehydration fluids and lots of companies that try to make it taste good. But the point is, yeah, you need that particular ratio. Most of the quote-unquote adult sports electrolyte drinks, they're too sweet. And so you're getting more sugar than you need, and they don't have as much salt. And it's really the salt and the potassium, the sodium and the potassium and the chloride that you need for electrolyte replacement, because that's what you're sweating out. And so the absolute, it's designed for diarrhea if you're running and you have eaten and you are capable of drinking water. You're much safer drinking water than even oral rehydration drinks, because I would worry about someone giving themselves too much salt because they're sweating out a lot of salt, but now they're drinking salt and sugar in the right proportion, so they're slamming salt into their system. And you could easily overshoot on the sodium, not be sweating it out as fast as you thought you were, and get yourself salt overloaded, which is not a good idea. So I'm against all of these electrolyte drinks. I think, you know, water in an energy bar is much safer.
Yeah, I don't drink those, and I've been low carb for about 10 years, so I was just kind of, why do I need to have the sugar with it?
You don't. And, just a tiny bit. And we're talking about 15 calories of sugar per liter here, or something like that. I mean, let's see. How many teaspoons? It's 8. Is it, it's 8 ounces of water.
I thought it was 8 teaspoons.
That's in a liter.
I thought it was 1 liter of water.
It's 1 liter of water. It's 8 teaspoons. And so when you think about drinking 8 ounces of that, that's the amount of sugar in that.
Oh, okay.
See, it's 30 calories worth of sugar.
That's what you reminded me of when you were talking before I got on the air. My question was, visiting the desert, I've had a lot of problems with nocturnal leg cramps, and, you know, people say potassium, eat a banana, which I don't eat bananas. I'm taking magnesium supplements. I use light salt. Couldn't stay ahead of them. And then I thought, well, with the light salt, maybe I'm not getting enough salt. My blood pressure is 100 over 60. So I'm not really concerned about salt, but eating low carb, I eat mostly just whole foods.
Right, exactly.
And I thought, well, maybe I'm just not getting enough salt. So is there I've heard some recommendations. Finney and Bolick did the fat-adapted athletes and said that if your salt gets low, your body will dump potassium.
I don't remember how many
grams, but, you know, they're saying you should be eating a teaspoon or two of salt a day. You know, which is more than I think I would use on my food. So I just wondered if what it occurred to me that I'd never heard you talk about sodium. And I think that's where I'm lacking rather than the other.
Okay, so can you specify your question? Because I'm not quite, what's the question about sodium?
I think the DASH diet and everything has got so many people avoiding it.
Right,
And I just wondered if there's what our intake should be or what we should base it on, so I don't get to where I have to remember what the 811's for.
right, exactly. All right, so
if I don't have incredibly high blood pressure and I'm not at risk of stroke, do I need to worry about how much salt I consume?
Yes, you do. What
would be the indicator if I did consume too much salt?
Well, you wouldn't necessarily notice anything. You might get a little. You might retain a little fluid. So, if you start retaining salt, water follows salt is kind of the basic physiology. So, if you eat more salt, your body will hold on to more water. And you'll pee less because your kidneys will be sucking salt. The kidneys will be pulling water out of your urine, and in order to do that, the kidneys have to pull salt out of your urine. I know it's paradoxical. So what they will do is you will dump potassium and reabsorb salt in a situation of dehydration. And if you're in a situation of high salt intake, your body, I said that backwards. Let me start again. Let's suppose you're eating 5 grams of salt, 5 grams of salt a day. That's a teaspoon of salt a day. That's more than the recommended addition of salt. That'd be a lot of salt. The first thing that happens is that your kidneys change the gradient. They start changing their desire to pull salt out of the urine, and they start dumping salt into the urine. You generally don't see the potassium go up by more than a tenth of a point, so it's not that obvious for the potassium, because most of the potassium in your body is inside the cells. So when we draw blood, It's not that apparent. But you can see with diet, you'll see an if you started eating more salt, initially you'll see a bump in the salt in the bloodstream. And then it'll start trickling down as the kidneys adjust their filtering functioning to quit reclaiming salt. The kidneys basically exist to prevent you from having too low a salt. And so you filter your blood, which is high in salt, and now you have a clear fluid with no cells in it that's high in salt. And the first loop of the kidney, because it's kind of this crazy roller coaster, if you look at the loop of Henle, H-E-N-L-E, it looks like, you know, something on a roller coaster ride, a really scary roller coaster. But what's happening as you do that is you're pulling sodium out of that very high sodium fluid, and then you're putting something, and then let's suppose that, and then you're just letting it go. If you need to keep more water, if the person's not also overhydrated, then you'll concentrate the urine. You dump all the toxins in, and then if you still need more water, you start putting potassium in, and you'll get more water that way. And so you're trading salt for potassium on the other end, so you're pulling more salt in, and the kidneys are just looking at how much salt do I have, how much water, which they gauge by the blood pressure and by something called renin in the bloodstream. And it is a very, very dynamic kind of AI that's job is to regulate solutes in the blood, the little chemicals floating around in the blood. Very, very important to life, and basically, if we're not going to breathe, to drink salt water and stay in the ocean, and we want to go up here and drink still water with no salt in it and walk around on land and sweat, we really need to hold on to salt. And that's sort of the kidney's main job. And then we came along and we said, salt improves the flavor of food, and look, here are salt mines, and salt becomes actually a currency. Did you know that salt was actually a mm-hmm. currency? Like some tribes use in South, right. They used mm-hmm. cowrie shells. Well, salt was a big deal back there in the biblical times. And in fact, there's mm-hmm. some quotes in the Bible about it. Salt of the earth and all of that. The point is that we're now messing with that majorly with our cultural practices. So the safe zone on salt, according to the American Kidney Association, is about 2 grams. So that's, a little under half a teaspoon. Call it a third of a teaspoon. And it's a little less than that. So in there, let's call it, so if you don't add more than a quarter teaspoon of salt, and that includes processed food, you're in pretty good shape. And you aren't going to be getting more salt than you need, and you won't be driving any diseases. Now, when I put people on, say, a paleo diet, or they want to go on a high-protein diet, that changes the rules, because one of those toxins that your kidney has to get rid of as part of its job is nitrogen. And it gets rid of it in the form of urea, but that's a byproduct of protein. Basically, the first thing you do with an amino acid, if you're going to use it for fuel and turn it into glucose, is you chop off that protein. If you're going to use it as a building block, you don't have to do that. You just break it down to amino acids and build things with it. But a lot of the protein we eat actually gets used as food, and there's all this nitrogen floating around. When you start eating paleo, your nitrogen goes way, way up. So the thing you absolutely do not want to do is start being a paleo person, consume lots more nitrogen, and not give your kidneys enough water, because that is just as unhealthy as eating too much salt. The reaction is different because the reason that too much salt raises your blood pressure, and it has to, and it's much worse in African Americans than it is in or people of African ancestry, because they don't have to be African Americans; they could be Franco Africans. It would be the same thing. Is that when you give people with that DNA too much salt, they retain water like crazy, and it really kicks their blood pressure up. It's less of a problem in quote-unquote salt-insensitive individuals, but it's still going to cause an increase in your fluid volume, the total amount of water in your body. And a lot of times in Caucasians, instead of driving up their blood pressure, what it does is it causes them to be puffy. And so they'll have edema in the legs, and they'll have an increased blood volume, and that works the heart harder. So I have lots of patients.
But I would notice that.
Yeah, you would. So,
right. So I'd have indications.
Yeah. The most important thing to watch as you age is your GFR. That is glomerular filtration index. And that number is, nowadays it's usually estimated. If when you get a blood test for a basic chemistry, it'll tell you, you know, your GFR is above 65, you're good. Unless you're African American, the number is different. And but if your GFR is declining, and you look at your old test and you see that it's going downhill, I usually when someone wants to go like really strong paleo, and they're kind of marginal on the kidney function, I'll check it again in a month after they've been doing all this protein. And I want to make sure that I'm not seeing a decline in the GFR. And if I am, it's like, dude, either drop the diet or drink a whole bunch more water than you're doing, because you're straining your organ. And this is an organ that has to stay in good shape your entire life. And
what was the GFR stood for?
Glomerular filtration rate. And glomerular is this little ball of, this is the glomerulus is the roller coaster. It's this structure that is sitting in the kidney that is the first line filter before you get the post processing that I was talking about in the loop of Henle.
Okay, so it's how well it's working.
It's how well it's working, and if that starts
it's overloaded.
And what you're looking at is a protein. And anyway, it's a protein that reliably shows up in the urine at a certain amount that's proportionate to your muscle mass. And so it's a little, it'll fool you. So if you get the skinny little old lady, I don't know if you're skinny and I don't even know if you're old, but so please no ad hominem. It's not an ad hominem. I'm not making any assumptions here. No assumptions at all. I think you're female. But I'm not sure. We're not even going to go there. But the point is that the person who has low muscle mass will have a different GFR because they don't have a lot of muscle protein being broken down, and so they won't have a lot of creatinine. So their GFR can be normal when they actually it should be lower, but if it can be quote unquote, oh, this is normal, but it's not normal for a really skinny person. It's normal for a person of average weight. So
because it doesn't have the muscle mass to, when you're talking with
exactly
you don't have much muscle mass to break down.
Yeah,
right?
So
because when you lose it, it's hard to get back. I'm turning 60 and I'm already seeing it.
Oh yeah, I know. And you know, weightlifting. There's two things I want to tell you on the subject of not losing your muscle mass. And one of them is you got to do resistance training with weights. And I don't mean little, you know, 5-pound little
right.
things. I mean, we're talking like, well, like I've been weight training for a couple of years now. And when I work my triceps, I'm doing, you know, on the pull down machines, I'm doing 30 pounds because
right.
that anything less than that is too, I'm not really hurting the muscle. And you need to make the muscle mildly sore. For me, it's at 48 hours. When you make the muscle mildly sore, it builds. And so you have to do that all the time. And you have to keep doing it.
Right.
At least once a week. I try to do 2 ice, but I manage once, and I'm not lying about that. I'm happy when I manage twice. 3 is like that impossible.
Right.
It's like my Fitbit. I don't get the 8 hours. You know, it's there in my goal, but it's a goal.
Well, yeah,
getting back to weight training, one more thing. To keep your muscle mass,
mm-hmm.
besides weight training, you also need to take some leucine. That's one of the amino acids, L-E-U-C-I-N-E. Because it turns out, leucine actually goes into the cell of the muscle. It goes into the nucleus, and it goes and sits on the DNA as a promoter to make more myosin muscle protein. So it stimulates the cell to make the messenger RNA for the building block of the muscle. So if you're doing that and you're co-stimulating it, you're basically saying, okay, I need more muscle because I'm putting demand on the tissue, and oh, by the way, I'm taking leucine, which is going to facilitate that signaling. It really, really helps.
Okay, you just gave me another question.
Okay.
If I eat a fairly high-protein, high-fat diet, why do I need all these amino acids? I mean, I hear several, lots of amino acids recommended, and I'm just wondering why I don't get them from meat, or are they not...
Oh, no, you get them from meat. You get them in a nice, balanced form. The doses I'm talking about, when I tell people, you need 5,000 milligrams of glutamine, these aren't nutrients anymore. These are nutraceuticals. So I like to use the word weaponize. I'm taking something
so
that's...
How much of the leucine?
About 5,000 milligrams, about a teaspoon of powder.
Okay.
And what we're doing is you can lower cholesterol if you take enough niacin, but you're taking something like 2,000 times the minimum, the recommended daily requirement. And at that,
I feel like I'm just trying to match somebody's number scheme on that. So
yeah, you have to ask what's the recommendation? Is it a dietary recommendation for nutrition? This is how much you need not to develop a deficiency disease. That's what the MDR is. And sure, none of us want deficiency diseases. So,
right. Okay.
Okay. So that's what that is on the back of the thing. And that's true. Now let's ask a different question. I have this problem. Let me pick something. I have a problem because I've got ulcerative colitis and my gut has to keep healing itself all the time. What can I do to help my gut heal itself faster? And well, in that case, the answer is about 5,000 milligrams of L-glutamine, because that's like giving extra food. That's a substrate. So the cells will burn it and it helps them grow faster. So it's kind of the, Wonder Bread for colonocytes. So you give Wonder Bread to make them grow stronger 12 ways, right? I love that ad. I always just see the line of kids getting bigger and bigger, and I don't advocate Wonder Bread, but man, that was some good advertising, because when I was a kid, I wanted to grow as tall as possible. I wanted my Wonder Bread,
And two cavities was a good thing.
Yeah, well, that's a different conversation.
It's all marketing. Okay, so on amino acids, is it tryptophan that helps the increased production of serotonin?
Yes, it is. And
so, MTHFR have a problem producing serotonin?
Yes, but not because they don't have enough tryptophan. Although they might also not have enough tryptophan. MTHFR people have a problem making serotonin because they don't convert the folic acid into the right stuff. And so,
right, but what helps overcome that? Because
you'd have to take folic acid that has already had the methyl group added at the 5 point. So it's the 5 tetra. It's the tetrahydrofolate. 5-metro. I have to start over and say methyl tetrahydrofolate reductase. That makes tetrahydromethylfolate.
Right.
And that's what you want, tetrahydromethylfolate. We're running up to the end of the hour. I want to tell you, you're our best regular caller. Thank you again for your call.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too.
Bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.